Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host Addressing Anti-Semitism in Higher Education, featuring Mark Goldfelder, Nadine Strawson, and Alexander Tsessis. Our moderator today is Ilya Shapiro. Mr. Shapiro is Senior Fellow and Director of Constitutional Studies at the Manhattan Institute. He has previously served as Executive Director and Senior Lecturer at the Georgetown Center for the Constitution, as well as Vice President of the Cato Institute, directing its Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies. He has testified before Congress on numerous occasions and has authored more than 500 amicus briefs in the Supreme Court. He has contributed to a number of academic, popular, and professional publications and has written several books, most recently Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites, which will be released in January. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Mr. Shapiro, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Well, thanks for that, Marco, and thanks to all of you for joining this important discussion on what to do about anti-Semitism in higher education. Indeed, the October 7th massacre showed that the heart of anti-Semitism in America lies on campus among the most educated and so-called progressive people. That's where calls for Israel's annihilation began, even before the IDF went into Gaza, which has exposed the deep rot in academia. As Bill Ackman put it in a revelatory essay the day Harvard President Claudine Gay resigned, anti-Semitism is the canary in the coal mine, a warning about larger issues. It's always a leading indicator of underlying pathologies. And in this case, that means everything from cancel culture to ideological indoctrination, intellectual corruption, to moral decay. We've seen a subversion of the core mission of universities to seek truth and develop human knowledge, and of classical liberal values like free speech, due process, and equality under the law. In my view, the root cause of all of this is a noxious postmodern ideology that contends that truth is subjective and must be filtered through a privilege hierarchy. Your rights depend on whether you're in a class deemed oppressor or oppressed. There's also a false narrative of decolonization that provides the intellectual bulwark behind the anti-Israel and anti-Jewish machinations. Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of Berkeley Law, wrote a year ago that as a 70-year-old Jewish man, quote, "Never in my life have I seen or felt the anti-Semitism of the last few weeks." While some of us were less surprised, given the anti-Israel, anti-American, and generally anti-Western ideology that's taken root in higher ed, and we lawyers have plenty of tools to combat this anti-Semitism, from university policies to the First Amendment, Title VI lawsuits to government investigations. Here to discuss the relative merits of these legal remedies are three prominent experts with diverse, in the true sense of the word, experiences. They'll go in the following order. First, we have Rabbi Dr. Mark Goldfeder, who's the CEO and director of the National Jewish Advocacy Center. He served as the founding editor of the Cambridge University Press series on law and Judaism, and as a presidential appointee to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum Council. Then we'll have Alexander Sasha Tsessis, who's the DeLambert Chair in Constitutional Law at Florida State University College of Law. He's also the general editor of the Cambridge Studies on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties and the Oxford Theoretical Foundations in Law. And then my good friend Nadine Strawson, who's a New York Law School professor emerita and a senior fellow at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE, and was the national president of the ACLU from 1991 to 2008. So with that, Rabbi Goldfeder, let's kick it off.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. And thank you for having me. My name is Mark Goldfeder. I'm director of the National Jewish Advocacy Center, a legal nonprofit that fights anti-Semitism in all of its different manifestations. And it's truly an honor to be on this esteemed panel here with all of you this afternoon. I want to frame my remarks in terms of the re-election of President Trump, which was historic for a number of reasons. And one of them is the potential for a very significant reset on how the federal government responds to acts of unlawful anti-Semitism. You know, law enforcement generally often depends on prosecutorial discretion. And until now, there has been very little executive branch appetite to hold those who are perpetrating unlawful acts of anti-Semitism accountable. And God willing, that will change when the new administration takes over in January. So I want to lay out five important steps that the federal government should, and thank God by all reports, will immediately take to counter the rise in anti-Jewish discrimination that we have seen since October 7th. The first is to simply issue guidance on the application of the First Amendment. On campuses across the United States, Jewish students are being harassed and intimidated, and in too many cases, administrators are hiding behind the First Amendment, pretending it's all about free speech. The Department of Justice and or the Department of Education should emphatically communicate that the First Amendment is not some mystery that no one knows how to apply and that the government expects universities to uphold it consistently and correctly. To be clear, the First Amendment is not a free pass to threaten, harass, intimidate, or otherwise violate the rights of others. There are limits to what constitutes speech, and there are rules for when it crosses over into actionable unlawful conduct. For example, the First Amendment does not protect arson or trespassing, vandalism, harassment, assault, destruction of property, doesn't protect against threats or intimidation or incitement. Protests are absolutely an important part of a functioning democracy, but schools can and must impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions to ensure that everyone's rights are protected. And schools don't have to wait for more people to get hurt. The Supreme Court in Healy versus James in 1972 cited the famous case of Tinker versus Des Moines to hold that university officials do not have to tolerate or allow student activities that breach reasonable campus rules, interrupt the educational process, or interfere with other students' rights to receive an education. And this is especially true when the student speech is happening in school-sponsored forums or is reasonably perceived as bearing the imprimatur of the institution. So think, for example, of SJP at NYU. Under Bethel versus Fraser in 1986 and Hazelwood versus Kohlmeier in 1988, schools have even greater latitude to limit student expression if they can establish a legitimate pedagogical concern. And I would say that ensuring all students, including Jewish students, have a safe and harassment-free environment in which to learn is or should be an overwhelmingly legitimate pedagogical concern. Which leads to the next thing, which is enforce Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Under Title VI, institutions that take federal funds have an obligation to protect their Jewish students and all students from discrimination based on race, color, or national origin. During his first term, President Trump issued Executive Order 13899 on combating anti-Semitism, which, among other things, incorporated the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, the IHRA, definition of anti-Semitism into Title VI. Now, this should have clarified any remaining concerns that discriminating against Jewish people for any aspect of their Jewish identity, including a real or perceived connection to the State of Israel, is unlawful. But for the last 4 years, the federal government has repeatedly delayed issuing the regulations that are needed to fully implement this order. So the incoming administration should immediately issue those proposed regulations, and they should also expand the order to include all other federal anti-discrimination laws. There's no reason, for example, as we have argued in federal court, why it should be the right definition for a student in a classroom, but under Title VII, a different definition for the teacher in the classroom. As it relates to schools in particular, again, just to review, per the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, speech becomes harassing conduct when it is sufficiently severe, pervasive, or persistent so as to interfere with or limit the ability of students to join in or benefit from a university's services or activities. Many Jewish students, even professors, are literally afraid to go to class. And so if the words of Title VI mean anything, they have to protect against hostile environments like this. And yet until now, not a single university has lost any of its funding. Again, thank God the incoming administration has already made it clear that things will be different going forward, and that change really can't come any too soon. Relatedly, the incoming administration should enforce the various laws we have against providing support for terrorism. Under the Federal Anti-Terrorism Act, it's a crime if someone knowingly provides material support or resources to a foreign terrorist organization. Groups like SJP are openly working as agents of Hamas, handing out recruitment flyers on our campuses. My organization, the National Jewish Advocacy Center, has brought 5 Federal Anti-Terrorist Act lawsuits since October 7th, using the correlative civil cause of action to go after some of these bad actors. But we should never have had to do that, because the government should have been using the criminal provisions to protect our country. In addition to the ATA, the Immigration and Nationality Act mandates that those who are engaging in terrorist activity are barred from entering the United States, and eligibility also applies to those who have been persuading others to endorse or support any of these named terrorist groups. So those who have been unlawfully importing terrorism and anarchy can and should be deported. And relatedly, the Treasury Department has the ability to revoke the tax-exempt status of organizations that funnel donations to these terrorist groups, and they can and should use it to shut them down. We also need to enforce the laws governing the disclosure of foreign funds. Section 117 of the Higher Education Act requires schools to disclose foreign gifts that are above certain thresholds to the Department of Education. Recent studies have found that schools are simply ignoring this obligation, with billions of dollars of unreported funds flowing in from authoritarian Middle Eastern regimes. And the studies also found that the receipt of this undocumented money is associated with both the erosion of free speech norms and a rise in anti-Semitism. The Institute for the Study of Global Anti-Semitism and Policy found that from 2015 to 2020, institutions that accepted these undocumented funds had, on average, 300% more anti-Semitic incidents than those that did not. Now, the statute authorizes the AG to bring a civil action against an institution at the Secretary of Education's request whenever it appears that an institution has failed to comply with these requirements. So the DOE and the DOJ should work together to enforce these laws, including in the form of penalties for failure to follow the requirements and the withholding of additional grants. Finally, we should use everything, every tool at our disposal to expose and to break the network of organized criminal perpetrators. Much of the anti-Semitic unrest we've seen around the country has been fomented by a group of radical anti-Semitic organizations that are preying on the ignorant and the impressionable. And those groups have been working in concert to commit unlawful acts, and they should be held fully accountable. For example, Section 241 of Title 18 of the U.S. Code, as part of a series of measures known as the Ku Klux Klan Act, makes it a crime to conspire to injure, oppress, threaten, or intimidate any person exercising a right protected by the Constitution or federal law. Or RICO laws, the Racketeer Influence Corruption Organizations Act, which targets organized criminal activity and racketeering, right? Enhancing existing criminal punishments for acts that are done as part of an organized enterprise. There are dozens of cases in which anti-Semitic groups in question have perpetrated and taken credit for actions that would count as predicate acts under these relevant laws. And I'll end by saying that going after the entire infrastructure at this would be beneficial for a number of reasons. Aside from, you know, efficiency, you know, discovery could help uncover and eliminate the funding sources that are fueling this hate. And more importantly, exposing the organized nature of this movement could help open people's eyes to the underlying motives of these bad actors, many of whom are focused not only on Jews, as Professor Shapiro was saying, but on taking down the West. You know, it didn't take long this time for the chance to morph from death to Israel to death to America, and for the vandalism to move from Hillel and Chabad houses to George Washington statue and the Freedom Bell. We have to help remind our fellow citizens that what starts with the Jews never ends with the Jews, and that stopping anti-Semitic hate crimes is a matter of self-preservation for all Americans. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Professor Tsitsis.
Thank you so much, and thanks to the Federalist Society for this opportunity and for hosting this event. And I'm very grateful for my co-panelists and the powerful thoughts that Rabbi Goldfeder just articulated. Some of my comments are going to overlap. Obviously, one of the things that university authorities face is this twofold dilemma, wherein they have an obligation to protect free speech and education, but also to investigate acts of hostile environment. And therefore, many of them walk a tightrope, but in many cases, they simply don't take action against explicitly harassing conduct on campus. And we've seen that, obviously, in the last year in what has been going on following October 7th. The universities have an obligation to restrict dangerous communications and should reflect the on several overlapping and sometimes contradictory constitutional considerations and regulatory ones as well. Title VII, the anti-harassment principles of the Civil Rights Act of 1965, will be my focus. But before I go into that, let me just say that there's a tremendous limiting factor here, which is created, it has been created by the Supreme Court's libertarian approach to the First Amendment. This comes from a variety of cases, including RAV versus St. Paul, the St. Paul cross-burning case, and Town of Gilbert case dealing with signage. But in both cases, the court arbitrarily and inaccurately stated that all content-based regulations should get the highest level of Supreme Court scrutiny. That is to say, that they are almost it's almost impossible to proceed on cases where there is some content-based regulations. As Dr. Goldfeder just pointed out, there are in fact many laws that do involve content regulations, and the Supreme Court doctrine does not reflect that in its content-based restrictions. There is intentional threatening of cross-burning, material support for terror, even some of the ones that he didn't mention, voting 100, saying things in electioneering or campaigning 100 feet from an election station, medical and legal advice without a license as a restriction on content and viewpoint, obscenity laws, fraud laws, defamation, and so on and so forth. So one of the major problems is that the court has overstated the restriction on content without getting into the nuances and the values that are involved in the First Amendment. And in an area on this, and this is where I want to focus on U.S. college campuses, is that similar to the workplace, sexism, true threats are narrowly tailored methods of preventing persons from using various statements of which they're aware or have knowledge or the purpose of supporting terrorist organizations or severely harassing others and other victims. Turning to U.S. college campuses, the expression of ideas, even obnoxious ones that make certain people feel uncomfortable, are not actionable. They are protected under the First Amendment. So we have to separate the discussion and disagreement that's inevitable in a political culture that's pluralistic from those sorts of statements that are harassing. Some of the examples which have been documented both in the Stanford report and Columbia University report, and also from the Congressional Committee, the Republican-led Congressional Committee on Education, have included bias and intimidation, anti-Israel bias that creates a level of social injury by using manifest anti-Semitic tropes. The reaction is not only ones that affect Jewish students, where in some cases they're very left of center and are extremely critical of Israel's policies, but nevertheless are harassed, indicating that the harassment is really being directed at them as Jews. But something that's typically not mentioned is that the comments and the restrictions on individuals because of their being Israeli are xenophobic. And this also should be something that should not get First Amendment protection, and typically does not, right? Nationality in and of itself is a protected category. We've seen mezuzahs taken off of doors with almost no investigations, student residences where individuals felt uncomfortable coming into their RAs who received complaints, DEI officers who received complaints without actually acting adequately on those reports, not getting back to students, and just as far as we know, not investigating. There are all sorts of disruptions of classrooms, student events, academic work environments where people were unable to enter the library. We're intimidated to do so. We're unable to take exams, and none of these have proceeded to actions that by the universities, or let me to be more accurate, very small actions, often withdrawn after they're taken. So they're taken, the media picks up on this, the headlines appear as if the university's taking these matters seriously, and then oftentimes the complaints are withdrawn. Time, place, and manner is just one of the methods of making these restrictions, where the universities have a substantial concern in education and making sure that their students are not harassed. That's unrelated to the free flow of information and expression, and where the effect on speech is really incidental in preventing hostility. I want to focus a bit on the hostile environment on campus, and much of this was covered by Dr. Goldfeder, but on the other hand, it's worth mentioning that Title VI is a program under, I said Civil Rights Act of 65, and the Civil Rights Act of 1964, where a recipient of federal assistance has to prevent harassing conduct, physical, verbal, or graphic, or even written. And the Department of Education is meant to enforce these actions. The Attorney General of the United States can bring lawsuits against the universities. This is a matter that's under the spending clause program. So universities receive funding, and hence they have certain obligations to protect the student body and education pursuant to this statute. So that where institutions fail to resolve disparate treatment or disparate effect, liability can ensue against the universities. And I agree for sure that the federal government should take action. The harassment is a matter of severe, pervasive, and persistent conduct that sufficiently creates an environment where students are unable to be educated, students are afraid to take certain courses, avoid certain areas of the university, including quads, libraries, and classrooms, in order to avoid having communications that are not within the parameters of the free speech clause of the First Amendment. I'm going to stop there. I have some other comments, but I want to engage in a conversation and to hear your questions. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Sasha. Nadine.
Hi there. I'm happy to join my esteemed colleagues. I had asked that I go last precisely so that I could hear what Mark and Sasha had to say, and knowing that there would be a lot of overlap, and see what complementary or to some extent somewhat different perspectives I would bring to bear. I would say my most important message was actually on this topic, which I've been talking about incessantly, not only after October 7th, but before that, is really summarized in the title of my book. So, Ilya, you flashed yours. Here's mine from 2018. Hate, why we should resist it with free speech, not censorship. And I fully appreciate that my esteemed colleagues have laid out First Amendment principles, which are not and should not be absolute. There are many kinds of expressive conduct, including certain pure speech, that in particular contexts should be punished, either because they violate what Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis crafted as the so-called emergency principle, when speech not considered based on its offensive or hateful or hated viewpoint, but considered in the overall context, imminently threatens or directly causes certain specific serious harm. And I do think, Sasha, that if you look at the Supreme Court's case law, it really, with the sole exception of obscenity, all of the other categories of unprotected speech really are defined contextually, not based only on the content or the viewpoint, but considered that they, you know, defamation obviously is a harm to reputation. A true threat is obviously a harm to freedom of speech and privacy and so forth. And I think that that principle is really important for two reasons. Number one, to protect the freedom of thought and expression, which is always especially important for all minority groups, certainly including Jews, and certainly including Zionists on college campuses. We are embattled minority groups. We're never going to have, or I think in the foreseeable future, not going to have majority power on our side. So we really especially depend on a robust freedom of speech. The other reason why I, and much more importantly, Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish Supreme Court justice, urged that the fitting answer to evil counsels is good ones. He said repressing hateful ideas will only increase hate. And for all of my studies of the causes of hatred and discrimination, including anti-Semitic, anti-Zionist, anti-Israeli, have to do with attitudes, with disinformation, with misinformation, some of the phenomena that Ilya pointed to in his opening remarks. And the law is simply not going to be able to address these fundamental problems in our universities and in our culture. They can only be corrected through a laborious, to be sure, process of education and information. Now, to be sure, I do agree that we have to enforce limits, appropriate limits on free speech. And I was really struck when Ilya, at the beginning, you listed what are the tools that are available. And you said one of the tools that are available for countering anti-Semitism is the First Amendment itself. And I have to say that since October 7th, I have become much more aware than I previously was that having a meaningful exercise of free speech on campus and elsewhere depends not only on government not punishing constitutionally protected speech, but also depends on government punishing speech that is not constitutionally protected, because those limits, for example, on intimidation and harassment and bullying and true threats and so forth, they are designed to protect the free speech of those who are the targets of the harassment and bullying. So I know Sasha and I for many years have had very friendly and constructive debates about, I think it's fair to say that I would construe limits on free speech as narrowly as possible. And Sasha has a somewhat different perspective. But whatever our perspectives are in general, I really urge that we insist on a consistent application and enforcement of those principles. I think one of the dangers that I've seen, and I'm not saying that about anybody on this panel, but too many mostly conservatives or even libertarians who have been very critical about limits on free speech that they consider to be unjustifiable are more sympathetic to similar limits on anti-Semitic speech. And I think that kind of double standard is really corrosive for the underlying robustness of free speech that Jews and Zionists are going to have to continue to rely on. Now, that said, even somebody who is a strong free speech protectionist, myself and FIRE and other organizations that I'm associated with, there is a lot of low-hanging fruit out there. As both of my esteemed co-panelists have said, we've even seen incidents on campus of assaults that seem to have gone unpunished, or disruptive conduct that is interfering with the functioning of the university, classes having to be shut down, campuses shut down. I live right around the corner from Columbia University, where the gates are still locked. People do, even faculty members do not have access to certain parts of the campus. You know, I've been invited to speak at Columbia, and I can't invite any members member of the public to those talks. So, I mean, this is a real tragedy and travesty. Other low-hanging fruit is discriminatory enforcement of so-called content neutral time, place, and manner regulations. Now, I haven't done independent factual investigations. I'm relying on complaints that I've read and decisions by courts on motions to dismiss. And in the Harvard case, for example, poignant to me because I'm a Harvard alum, the judge very persuasively and distressingly, now these were allegations, there hasn't yet been a trial, but the allegations were that Harvard was allowing disruptive protests of students that were occupying major areas in like the student cafeteria and library, pro-Palestinian protesters. And when some pro-Israeli group said, well, we want to demonstrate in the same place, suddenly Harvard said, oh no, that place is completely off limits. So, I mean, this kind of blatant low-hanging fruit that clearly violates the First Amendment, there have to be enforcements. But on some of the other details, I would be very, very concerned, for example, material support for terrorism. By the way, I wrote a piece about this last year. It was commissioned by some here, and it was co-authored by Ken Stern, the longtime head of the anti-Semitism actions by the American Jewish Committee and the primary author of the IRA definition of anti-Semitism. And the pull quote on our article, whose headline was SJP Still Deserves Freedom of Speech, was the strong protections U.S. law affords to much hateful expression are especially important for members of any minority group, very much including Jews and Zionists on campus. So material support for terrorism, even though I disagree with the Supreme Court's decision in Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, which rejected an ACLU challenge to that law as being overly broad, but even in the contestably or arguably overbroad interpretation, the Supreme Court was very clear that even advocacy alone was not enough, that there had to be coordination with or command by the terrorist organization for that to constitute material support. And it's quite possible, I don't know, that some of the student conduct on chapters of SJP have crossed the line. You know, if they're doing fundraising for Hamas, then certainly that warrants punishment. But even the most odious expression standing alone would not be sufficient. Also, in terms of fundraising, Mark, I couldn't follow all of your proposals, but I was, you know, immediately concerned about attempts that have been made in the past to limit fundraising in earlier portions of our history, to limit fundraising by pro-civil rights organizations during the civil rights movement. So I think my bottom line is we have to be really, really rigorous in ensuring that the standards that we are seeking to be enforced in this particular context, where all of us have particular reasons to hate the message that is being conveyed, that we're really rigorous in making sure that these are the same standards that we would advocate if it was a government that is in opposition to our views and was censoring, for example, pro-Israeli speech on the rationale, if you can believe it, that some people might muster that that's pro-genocide, right? So that's one other thing about Title VI. It may seem like a small distinction, but FIRE and others have made a lot, have stressed it, and given how factually dependent the assessment necessarily is of whether expression constitutes hostile environment harassment that should be punished under Title VI. The only Supreme Court language on point is from the Davis decision, and the exact definition was that the harassment, including expression, has to be so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive, so it's an and, not an or, that it effectively bars the victim's access, not limits, access to an educational opportunity or benefit. So two verbal distinctions between that and the formulation which OCR has put out, which, you know, given how fact-dependent and nuanced these issues are, that could well make a difference. And I do think we should put the thumb on the scales in favor of free speech.
Great. Well, Nadine, you hit upon every little note that I had made to ask about for discussion in Mark and Sasha's presentation. So I want to dig a little bit deeper, because I think we're all in agreement about time, place, and manner regulations, and especially since we're talking about the campus environment here, you know, disrupting classes, blocking student access to buildings, all of these things are not gray areas. And even when Barry Weiss at the Free Press tried to kind of foment disagreement between you and me, Nadine, about free speech, it turns out that when we had these, well, not really, they were kind of complementary, it turns out, rather than point counterpoint about the protections of free speech and the limits to it. But is it just in the campus context? Is it just a matter of enforcing existing rules, or do we need new kinds of policies or outside action in addition or instead when the policies are inadequate?
Well, I suppose I can go first. One is that I think that the U.S. Supreme Court cases are inadequately nuanced as to the balance that's involved, not only just in matters of education, but matters of harassment more generally, where they take this very hard line, and it creates a possibility of judicial supremacy, of arbitrarily finding certain very harmful forms of expression, ones that are protected, that are not so in Europe, where it's balanced and reason is used. I want to just go very quickly about this, the question about more speech. It isn't just Brandeis that says it, but of course, more famously, his colleague Justice Holmes. But historical examples indicate that, for at least for Jews, and I want to concentrate on that, although I could speak about Native Americans and Blacks and Mauritanian slaves and others on this, that in fact, the worst forms of anti-Semitism did not bring truth, did not bring democracy. And that was true, certainly, of Luther's anti-Semitism. That was true of the anti-Semitism in Germany. I can name a variety of speakers, including Otto Glagau, Wilhelm Marr, who was the one who coined the expression antisemitismus, Adolf Stoker. These were anti-Semites of the 19th century whose slogans the Nazis adopted. It did not lead to more protection of Jews, but rather to a greater acceptance of anti-Semitism amongst the Jewish culture, amongst the German culture, until it became part of their politics and part of the generally accepted views that allowed the Nazis to perpetrate the Holocaust.
Well, I know that we've debated the historical evidence, but so it's a subject to debate. But many respected historians point to a very strong record of anti-hate speech laws in the Weimar Republic and earlier in German history that were very strictly enforced, including against Nazis, including against Hitler himself, who was banned from public speaking in a big part of Germany. And as people who have been subject to censorship throughout history, they used it as a propaganda platform. And, you know, in Europe today, including Germany, has very strict anti-hate speech laws that are being strictly enforced, and that has not effectively reduced a tide of anti-Semitic discrimination and violence and other kinds of discriminatory violence. Now, I acknowledge that the response could be, well, maybe they should have even stricter laws and even stronger punishments. But ultimately, ultimately, we are trying to change attitudes. And I'm a lawyer. I like to use legal tools, but I'm also an educator. And what I find really frustrating about what's going on campus, and I speak on campuses constantly, so I have a very good sense of what's going on. There are very few that are offering any courses in the history of the Middle East, the politics of the Middle East. Columbia infamously has a course on Zionism that is taught by an anti-Zionist, right? He's been teaching it for apparently for decades. I mean, we need to really, Ilya, I think you used the word corruption. We really have to get to the nub of this problem, which is the underlying ideas that are being purveyed. Censoring people from spewing the most hateful epithets is really only the tip of the iceberg. I want to get to the underlying iceberg.
I just want to very, very quickly just correct the historical error that Nadine made, and that is that laws are under-enforced in Europe, and Hitler was censored, but then the censorship for a certain number of years, but then that term was reduced. And if you look at, and I have the statistics, and we'd be glad to share them, the Nazi Party lost support when Hitler was censored. And as soon as he violated those laws and the Weimar Republic did not pursue litigation against him, all of a sudden the Nazi Party increased their numbers in the Reichstag.
I disagree.
Okay. The historical point apart, I don't think any of us are talking about implementing hate speech laws on campus or otherwise. And most of the discussion is about enforcing civil rights laws to allow students not to get beat up and harassed and blocked and vandalism, all of these things that are not speech. And so my question is, I know Mark, you want to jump in for a second. I can go to you with, I want to bring in some audience questions here, and I think that this goes to it. How can or should the government or any other outside actors for that matter compel universities to punish illegal behaviors or to uphold free speech? So in other words, what should be done by the government or anybody else on the outside to universities that do not follow First Amendment standards or relevant criminal law?
Again, I would just jump in and say, I think if we enforce the things that we all clearly agree on, right? No arson, trespassing, destruction of property, assault, false imprisonment, et cetera, things that we've literally seen on campus for the last year and a half, we would absolutely greatly narrow the issue and we wouldn't have to contend with so many of these problems in the first place. I also think that if we accepted the fact that Zionism is often a code word for Jew and that discrimination based on any aspect of Jewish identity, including the real or perceived connection to the state of Israel, is anti-Semitism, you would eliminate even more of that respective gray area. Again, the proposals that I was talking about, you know, I'll pick one for example. Professor Strassen, you said you were worried about what I said about fundraising. Let me tell you the kind of fundraising I think we should limit in terms of a 501c3. One of the lawsuits that we brought was against a group called the Palestine Chronicle. The Palestine Chronicle is a U.S.-based 501c3. Some of you may remember on June 8th, 2024, when the IDF revealed that the Palestine Chronicle was paying a writer named Abdallah Al-Jamal, who is an operative and an official spokesman for Hamas, who was holding three Israeli civilians hostage in his house, Almog Meiryan, Andrei Kozlov, and Shlomi Ziv. They were all kidnapped from Nova on October 7th. They spent 246 days in captivity, held prisoner by this man. That 501c3 should lose its funding for paying and supporting knowingly this member of Hamas. That's the kind of crazy level that we're talking about. Usually 501c3s do good work. Sometimes they're a front for a terrorist organization. And I think we need to absolutely stamp those out. So again, I think that we're getting into the weeds here. If only we had the freedom and ability and time to argue about the nuances of expression and when it crosses the line. But we are so far from that we have to focus on enforcement of the crazy extremes.
I really appreciate that, Mark, and please let's be on a first name basis as colleagues. Ilya, I'm curious for, I would love to hear your answer to your question. As a libertarian, do you actually support federal government intervention here to ensure that universities do comply with both free speech protections and the limits on free speech?
Well, I prefer to call myself a classical liberal, but regardless of that nomenclature, the almost everything that the federal Department of Education does is unconstitutional. But we live in a second order world where there is federal funding for lots of things, and there are strings attached to federal funding, rightly so. And those strings include everything from enforcement of federal civil rights and anti-discrimination law to accounting standards. And part of that is the ability to withhold funding on those universities that violate or allow the violation of students' civil rights, including free speech, including access to equal educational opportunities.
The False Claims Act for those who say that they're upholding the standards.
Sure, there's all sorts of other assorted legal barnacles and enforcement mechanisms. And so to the extent there is federal funding, absolutely the federal government can and should be involved as a steward of taxpayer money and things that are done by universities that have that federal attachment, just like for state universities, public universities, state legislatures can and do and should have a role in regulating all sorts of things, not what's spoken inside the classroom, other than in very limited cases about what, you know, germane subject matter. If, you know, a math professor shouldn't be teaching about Weimar history, that sort of thing. But otherwise, just in terms of being a steward and an overseer of the government's programs and funding. But anyway, we're getting a little far afield. I want to go back to audience questions. A first principles kind of fun question here. We're talking about anti-Semitism, talking about civil rights law, free speech law. For the purposes of federal constitutional law, is it more useful to think of Jews as a race, as an ethnic group, something about national origin, a religion, some sort of combination? I mean, and for the last 20 years or so, the Civil Rights Office of the Education Department, under administrations of both parties, has put out guidance saying that it's kind of the interstices of religion, ethnicity, national origin. But how do we think of Jews in the American civil rights legal architecture?
If I could jump in, one of the reasons why it's so hard to fight anti-Semitism is because Jewish identity is so multifaceted, right? It does encompass aspects of race, religion, culture, national origin, et cetera. That's why we need a good definition like IRA. But as it relates to the question about race, we should first define racism and racial discrimination. So racism is the belief that innate inherited characteristics biologically determine human behavior. It often involves the color of a person's skin, but not always. Racial discrimination, or discriminating based on race, is when people treat others differently, usually in a bad way, because of their perception of that other person's race, whether their perception is scientifically accurate or not. So for example, whether or not Jews are scientifically a race, whatever that term means, it is undeniably true that the Nazis killed 6 million Jewish men, women, and children because they believed, as enshrined in the Nuremberg Laws, that Jews were racially inferior. So Jews have clearly faced their share of racism and racial discrimination throughout history and often lost their lives for it. And again, even today, the vast majority of anti-Semitic incidents targeting Jewish people on campus or anywhere in the United States has nothing to do with this or that religious Jewish practice, right? Whether you keep Shabbat or not, everything to do with the target's perceived race or national origin, particularly as it relates to the state of Israel. And that's why, again, from a legal perspective, I think the question about Jews and race is simple. Jews are a distinct race for the purposes of civil rights laws and has been upheld in a number of different contexts in federal court.
And I think the definition that OCR and the Department of Education has used is very broad, whether you use the label race or ethnicity. It includes any kind of discrimination, including harassment, based on actual or perceived, which is interesting and important, shared ancestry or ethnic characteristics, or citizenship or residency in a country with a dominant religion or distinct religious identity. So even perceiving somebody as Israeli or misperceiving them as Israeli would be considered to be anti-Semitic under this definition, which I think is appropriately broad.
you say something very quickly. There's been a lot of conversation about this IRA definition, and I'm probably unusual in that I
probably
don't think
more controversy about the examples given than the definition itself.
That's true. Yeah, you're absolutely right. But I guess I'm one of the unusual people in the country that actually think that discussions of this nature actually deter from the recognition of anti-Semitism. I prefer a definition that was adopted. I mean, frankly, I just think that there are broad ways of speaking about it. Columbia, for example, has much broader explication of this in its second report on anti-Semitism, which is anti-Semitism is prejudice, discrimination, hate, or violence directed at Jews, including Jewish Israelis. And that anti-Semitism manifests in many ways, ethnic slurs, epithets, Holocaust denial, targeting Jews or Israelis for violence, celebrating violence against them, etc. I think, anti-Semitism has taken so many different forms that it's sort of like, you know, looking at a narrow definition and trying to create a narrow definition of sexism or racism. I mean, there are broad manifestations. Often they're contextual as well. And so I think it would be better to speak about anti-Semitism as it has been spoken about for millennia, as opposed to just trying to narrow and argue about one particular definition.
Yeah, I want to go back, Ilya, because to the relationship between free speech and civil rights law, because I think what's one, I just reread for the umpteenth time the OCR guidance that was put out in May. And I think it's really important that it does say that expression alone may constitute or contribute to at least hostile environment harassment. Now, that does not mean that it should be punished, but it does mean, according to OCR, and I completely agree with this because it's consistent with the Brandeis approach of even if you don't censor, you do something. And the OCR's position is even with respect to the expression, you have to do something. You've got to have some response, whether it's educating those students who are engaging in the discriminatory expression, whether it's providing support and counseling for the students who are the targets of the expression, whether it's trying to create a more inclusive campus environment. So, you know, again, I see these as complementary. Yes, we're going to punish speech to the maximum extent consistent with First Amendment principles that we consistently apply. And we are going to go beyond that to take other steps to try to counter and extirpate these pernicious ideas that are infecting our campus.
To tease out that distinction a little more, Nadine, is what you're talking about the difference between, say, a rally on the campus green with, you know, not blocking people's access or what have you, and not disturbing another group that's reserved the space or anything like that. A rally that's chanting hateful things, anti-Semitic things, and that same group of people marching up to the steps of the Hillel and chanting and directing those things at the Hillel. Is there a meaningful difference for purposes of regulating those activities or that speech?
Well, the speech itself could be directly punished, and I believe in the second situation as intimidation or what law calls a true threat. But I think what's interesting, and I tend to agree with the OCR, that even if you would not punish the untargeted chanting, it can be considered as contributing to a hostile environment, which then requires the university to take some steps. And the steps would not include punishing that speech, but it would recognize the harm that's being done to students who are targeted by it and try to get the university has a responsibility to do something.
Yeah, part of what universities can and should do so as to not be clearly deliberately indifferent to underlying statement in Title VI is to use their own speech to condemn those things and say that what they're doing is protected expression, but we, the university, want to express our values and that this is not the same.
And I just want to sharpen that point that you just made in passing, Mark. The university can be liable not just for its own things that it's affirmatively doing or its agents are doing that are infringing on civil rights or speech, but if it is aware of things going on and does nothing to stop that, that is the basis of all these suits, of a lot of these suits against Harvard, NYU, and these other things that you and the Brandeis Center and others have been bringing. Let's go for a different sort of question. I have a question from Jonathan Friedman, who says he was the president of the Harvard Law Alliance for Israel and spoke at the press conference at Congress before the infamous hearing of university presidents a year ago now. And he asks, how do we balance using the law to protect minority rights and U.S. interests with not creating dangerous precedent? And he mentions, for example, that a lot of dangerous precedent, I guess, whether it's speech harming or other individual rights violating, that's been created by DEI decision making on campus.
That's exactly the right question. And I so appreciate the work that the questioner has done. We have to enforce exactly the same speech protective standards up to intent, you know, either intentional incitement or true threats or intimidation. And we have to insist that those standards be rigorously enforced as we would want them to be enforced if it were pro-Israeli or, you know, pro-Jewish speech.
I agree. I think the key is correct and consistent
application. Consistent, right.
Please.
That's right. And in fact, one of the Title VI violation is disparate enforcement. Does that would fall under the Title VI definition?
What I found interesting in doing research for my book, Lawless, and in general, in following these sorts of discussions in the last year and a half, is that so much of the anti-Semitic activity, speech, what have you, is coming from inside the house, from these DEI offices that are charged with, you know, making it for an inclusive campus and what have you. There's a there's a study by put out by the Heritage Foundation about 2 years ago called Inclusion Delusion that goes into that. I think we have time maybe for one more question, very different type of question. The issue of tenure. And the faculty anti-Semitic behavior and speech that we've seen. When should tenure cease to be a safe harbor? Should it be eliminated more broadly? Should there be regulation of faculty speech? While you're still thinking of your thoughts, I'll just say that Keith Woodington has put out a great book and a couple of academic articles. If you want to really drill down on what's it called, extramural speech and other distinctions here, but what are the panelists' thought on?
And Keith has also written an article about the limits of free speech in the classroom, which has been a hot topic around the Columbia campus recently, as word has gotten out about one faculty member reportedly.
Well, another faculty member just resigned because of that.
Yeah, in protest over somebody teaching allegedly pro-Palestinian dogma in a speech, allegedly about Zionism. Now, I have no direct firsthand knowledge, but the academic freedom principles are that the professor, once you're assigned to teach a course, as long as what you're teaching is consistent with the disciplinary norms of your discipline, you have a great deal of discretion. Now, that would certainly not encompass teaching outright lies, but, you know, on the kind of analysis where Sasha and I disagree about how you interpret the history, I'm sure we would both introduce our students to differing perspectives, but I don't think either one of us could be accused of violating disciplinary norms. But beyond that, the university does have a power to decide what courses will be taught and who will teach them. And I think that's an area where the fact that somebody has tenure doesn't mean that they have a right to perpetually teach any course they want. And certainly they may not use a course about one subject to perpetrate their views on another subject entirely.
Yeah, I'll just, you know, point out that again, if only we were in this sort of nuanced thing. Yeah. What we've seen with Faculty for Justice, and academic freedom doesn't mean a faculty member can harass or threaten or intimidate or ridicule a student, which we have seen, but it also doesn't mean that they can impose his or her views on the students. They have to leave room for discussion. And what we're seeing here, again, unfortunately, more and more often, we've seen it more with TAs really than with faculty members, to be honest, are people saying like, oh, I won't allow Zionists to have an opinion because there's only one side here. And that is, I think, a violation of the students' academic freedom, not the professor.
And it's also contrary to the most basic academic freedom principles, going back to AAUP 1915 Declaration. One of the three cardinal foundations of academic freedom is that the purpose of the classroom is education, not indoctrination, to teach students how to think, not what to think. And Mark, I have also heard that it's by and large non-tenured, or there are a lot of non-tenured people or even non-tenured track people, where tenure would not be an obstacle to not rehiring them.
Right. That's right. My understanding is that the Columbia professor was actually an adjunct professor. I mean, the headlines that said professor, but when you drill down, it's really an adjunct professor. Everyone was lifting their book. Somebody asked a question about free speech. So she reminded us free speech in the balance. Mm-hmm. The closest example, I completely agree with Nadine. You have to be able to present a point of view, but and I totally agree with Mark as well. It can't be one that's harassing it and that students feel that they cannot take this course because they will be treated as outsiders and excluded. The closest example I'm aware of that was in Oberlin, where Joy Karinga had posted on her Facebook things about Israeli and Zionist Jews, that the Jews were involved, played a key role in the 9/11 attack. She had a bunch of stuff about Rothschild, and she was untenured. And that's one of the rare cases that I'm aware of that a tenured professor had said these sorts of things. There was a faculty council. She refused to participate. She was not removed. She was not denied tenure because of what she said, but rather because of her failure to engage with the faculty council's investigation. The other thing I want to say is these are not pro-Palestinian views. These are views that are supporting terrorism. Pro-Palestinian views are welcome. Pro-Israel views are welcome. Views that disagree with Israeli policy are welcome. Views that disagree with Palestinian policy are welcome in order to engage in conversation. The problem is that these are support for terrorism. I absolutely agree with Mark, and Nadine also reiterated this point, that if the support is found to be from these terrorist groups, and here I guess Nadine and I disagree because I think that Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project was decided correctly, that in that case, if there is a coordination, that is to say someone from—
I would say coordination would be enough, yeah.
Yeah,
I'll point you all. I don't have a book to hold up, but I'll point you all to the lawsuit that we brought with our partners at Greenberg Traurig and Holtzman Vogel and the Schoen Law Firm, Pariser versus AMP in the Eastern District in Virginia, where
you don't want to hold up your brief.
I had it. I hold it up. Where we demonstrate the coordination between National Students for Justice in Palestine and Hamas.
You said it again. Pariser versus
AMP.
AMP. Thank you.
All right. We're a few minutes over, so I think we have to leave it there. This webinar has been recorded. It'll be posted on the Federalist Society's events page. They're pretty quick about this, I imagine, by the end of the week. So thanks, everyone, for attending. Thank you to our panelists, and we are adjourned.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.